but everything would be fine.
Liar,
Xenia said pointedly.
Okay, when should I be worried?
In a year,
Artyom mumbled, hoping that this was inaudible enough, and he moved the tent flap aside and went out onto the platform.
Boy, you're slowing us down,
Bourbon said through his teeth. He was dressed as before, only he had a long rucksack on his back.
Fuck you. Are you planning to drag that big lump across every cordon with you?
He asked disgustedly, pointing at the machine gun. As far as Artyom could tell, Bourbon didn't have a weapon himself. The light at the station was fading. There was no one on the platform. Everyone had gone to sleep, exhausted from the feast. Artyom tried to walk faster, worried all the time that he would bump into someone from his group, but at the entrance to the tunnel, Bourbon trapped him and told him to slow his pace. The patrolmen in the passage noticed them and asked them from afar where they were planning to go in the middle of the night, but Bourbon addressed one of them by name and explained that they had some business to attend to.
Listen carefully, he said to Artyom, turning on his flashlight. Now there'll be guards at the 100th and 200th meter lines, so you just keep quiet above all. I will figure it out with them. Shame that you have a kalash that's as old as my grandma. You won't hide that thing. Where'd you dig up such a piece of crap?
Everything went smoothly at the 100th meter. There was a small fire dying out and two people were sitting next to it, dressed in camouflage. One of them was snoozing, and the second one shook Bourbon's hand like a friend.
Business, I see, he said with a mischievous smile.
Bourbon didn't say a word before the 250th meter. He just sullenly marched forward. He seemed sort of angry and unpleasant, and Artyom was starting to regret that he'd come with him. He stepped away from Bourbon and checked to see that his machine gun was in order, and he put his finger on the trigger. There was some delay at the last guard post. Bourbon either didn't know them well, or they knew him too well. The main guy took him off to the side, putting his rucksack by the fire, and asked him a lot of questions. Artyom, feeling pretty foolish, stayed by the fire and sparingly answered the questions of the duty officer. They were obviously bored and had nothing better to do. Artyom knew for himself that if the duty officer was chatty, then everything was fine at the post. If something strange had happened there recently, if something had crawled out of the depths, or someone had tried to break through from the south, or they'd heard a suspicious sound, then they would be crowding around the fire silently, saying nothing, tense, and they wouldn't take their eyes off the tunnel. It looked as though everything had been quiet, and that they could get at least a Prospekt Mir without worrying.
You're not from around here, I guess. From Alexeyevskaya, or what?
The duty officer was trying to elicit information from Artyom and looking at him right in the face. Artyom, remembering that Bourbon had ordered him to stay quiet and talk to no one, muttered something that could have been interpreted in several ways, leaving the guy to his own interpretation. The duty officer, having given up on getting an answer from him, turned to his mate and started discussing a story told by some guy called Mikhail, who had been training at Prospekt Mir a few days ago and had had some trouble with the station's administration. Satisfied that they'd given up on him, Artyom sat at the fire and looked at the southern tunnel through the flames. It looked like the same wide and endless tunnel as they had in the northerly direction at Vedienche, where Artyom had not so long ago sat by a fire at the 450th meter. By the looks of it, it wasn't different at all. But there was something about it, a particular smell brought up by the tunnel vents, or was it a particular mood, an aura that belonged only to this tunnel and gave it an individuality, made it dissimilar to all the rest? Artyom remembered his stepfather saying that there weren't two tunnels alike in the metro. Such supersensitivity had developed over many years of trips, and not many had it. His stepfather called it listening to the tunnel. And he had such a sense of hearing that he was proud of it and often admitted to Artyom that he had survived many adventures thanks to this sense. Many others, despite their many travels in the metro, had no such thing. Some people developed inexplicable fear, some heard sounds, voices, and slowly lost their minds, but everybody agreed on one thing. Even when there wasn't a soul in a tunnel, it was still not empty. Something invisible and almost intangible slowly and viciously dripped onto them, filling them with its being, almost like it was the heavy, cold blood in the veins of a stone leviathan. And now the duty officer's conversation was fading into the background as he tried in vain to see something in the darkness that was swiftly thickening about 10 paces from the fire. Artyom started to understand what his stepfather meant when he would tell him about the feeling of the tunnel. Artyom knew that beyond that indistinct boundary, marked by the flames of the fire, where crimson light mixed with shivering shadows, there were more people, other people. But in that moment he couldn't quite believe it. It seemed that life stopped 10 paces beyond the firelight, and that there was nothing in front of them, only dead, black emptiness that answered a shout with the deception of a dull echo. But if you sit for a while, if you plug your ears, if you don't look into the depths of the tunnel like you're looking for something, but instead you try to dissolve your gaze in the darkness, and to merge with the tunnel, to become a part of this leviathan, a cell in the organism, then through your fingers, that are closing off the sounds of the external world, past your auditory organs, a thin melody will flow directly into your brain, an unearthly sound from the depths, indistinct and incomprehensible. It's nothing like that disturbing, urging noise spilling out of the broken pipe in the tunnel between Alexeyevskaya and Ryshkaya. No, it's something different. Something clean and deep. It seemed to him that he could dip into the quiet river of this melody for short spells, and suddenly he would understand the essence of this phenomenon. Not using reason, but using an intuition that was probably awakened by that noise from the broken pipe. The flowing sounds from that pipe seemed to him the same as ether, slowly extending along the tunnel, but they'd been rotting inside the pipe, infected by something, seething nervously, and they broke out where tension in the pipe became too much, and the rotting matter pushed itself out into the world, taking its sorrow with it, imparting nausea and madness to all living beings. Suddenly it seemed to Artyom that he was standing on the threshold of an understanding of something important. As though the last hour he had spent wandering in the pitch-black darkness of the tunnels and in the twilight of his own consciousness had pulled the curtain of this great mystery slightly to the side, separating all rational beings from a knowledge of the true nature of this new world, which was gnawed into the earth's bowels by previous generations. But with this realization, Artyom also became scared. As if he had only had a peek through the keyhole of the door, hoping to find out what was behind it, and seeing only an unbearable light punching through it and singeing the eyes. And if you opened the door, then the light would gush out irrepressibly and incinerate the audacious person who decided to open the forbidden door on the spot. However, this light is knowledge. The whirlwind of all these thoughts, feelings, and worries came whipping through Artyom too suddenly, and he wasn't at all ready for anything like it, and so he recoiled in fright. No, this was all just a fantasy. He hadn't heard anything and hadn't realized anything. It was just a game of his imagination. With mixed feelings of relief and disappointment, he observed how, for an instant, an amazing, indescribable vision was revealed to him. It instantly grew dim, melted, and the mind again was faced with its usual muddy haze. He was afraid of this knowledge, and stepped back from it, and now the curtain was lowered again, and perhaps forever. The hurricane in his head died down as quickly as it had come, and he was left with a devastated and exhausted mind. Artyom was shaken and sat there trying to understand everything. Where his fantasy ended, and where reality began, wondering if any of these sensations might be real after all. Slowly, slowly, his soul was filled with bitterness at the fact that he had stood a step away from enlightenment, from the most real enlightenment, but he hadn't been resolute, he hadn't dared give himself to the flow of the tunnel's ether, and now he would be left to wander in the darkness for his whole life, because he was once too afraid of the light of authentic knowledge.
But what is knowledge?
he asked himself again and again, trying to give value to the thing that he had just refused in a hurried and cowardly manner. Sunk in his thoughts, he didn't notice that he had said these words aloud a few times.
"Knowledge, my friend, is light, and non-knowledge is darkness," one of the duty officers explained to him eagerly. "Right?"
He merrily winked at his friend. Artyom was dumbstruck and stared at the guy and sat like that for a while, until Bourbon returned and got him up and said goodbye to the officers, saying that he had been detained and that they were in a hurry.
"Watch it,"
the commander of the post said to him threateningly.
"I'm letting you leave here with a weapon."
He waved a hand at Artyom's machine gun.
"But you won't be coming back through with it. I have clear instructions on that."
"I told you, you blockhead,"
Bourbon hissed to Artyom in irritation after they'd hastily walked away from the fire.
"So you can do what you want on the way back, but you'll get a fight. I don't care. I just knew it. I knew that this would happen. Fuck you."
Artyom said nothing, almost not hearing Bourbon chiding him. Instead, he suddenly remembered what his stepfather said that time when he was explaining about the uniqueness of every tunnel, that each one has its own melody, and that you can learn to hear it. His stepfather probably wanted simply to express his thought beautifully, but remembering what he felt sitting at the fire moments ago, Artyom thought that he'd heard just such a melody. What he was listening to, really listening to, and hearing, was the melody of the tunnel. However, the memory of what happened quickly faded, and half an hour later, Artyom could not be sure that it had all really happened, and that he hadn't imagined it, that it wasn't air blown about by the playing flames.
"Okay, you probably didn't do it on purpose, you've just got shit for brains,"
Bourbon said in conciliation.
"If I'm, like, not very nice to you, I'm sorry, this is stressful work, but okay, seems we got out, so that's good. Now we have to trudge to Prospect Mir without being stopped. There we can, like, relax. If everything is quiet, then it won't take much time, but beyond that, there's a problem."
"So it's okay that we're just walking along like this? I mean that when we go in a caravan from Vedienche, if there's any less than 3 people, then we don't leave. You need a rear guard, and basically..."
Artyom said, looking behind himself.
"Well, there are pluses, of course, to going in caravan with a rear guard and all that,"
Bourbon started to explain.
"But listen here. There is a concrete minus to that, too. I used to be afraid and forget 3 people. We used to not go anywhere without at least 5 people. You think it helped? Doesn't help in the least. Once we were moving a cargo, and so we had protection, 2 in front, 3 in the middle, and a rear guard. Everything as it should be. We were going from Tretyakovskaya to what it's called, used to be called Marxistskaya. The tunnel was okay, but something about it I didn't like straight away. A certain decaying, and there was a fog. You couldn't see for shit. Not 5 paces ahead, and the flashlights didn't help much. But we decided to tie a rope to the rear guard's belt, drawn from the belt of one of the guys in the middle, and up to the commander at the head of the group, so no one would get lost in the fog. And we're moving at an easy pace, and everything's normal, quiet. There was no need to rush. We hadn't encountered anyone yet, touch wood, and we have about 40 minutes to go. Though we did it faster than that in the end."
His words twisted, and he went silent for a little while.
"Somewhere in the middle, this guy, Tolyan, asks the rear guard something, but the guy doesn't answer. Tolyan waited and asked again. Nothing. Tolyan then pulls on the rope, and the end of it appears. It's been bitten right through. Really, bitten through. And there's even some wet gunk on the end of it. And the guy is nowhere to be seen. And they didn't hear a thing. Nothing at all. And I was walking with Tolyan myself. He showed me the end of the rope, and my knees quaked. Of course, we shouted back at him for the sake of it, but didn't hear anything. There wasn't anyone there to answer. So we exchanged glances and went forward so that we were at Marxistskaya in no time.
Maybe the guy was playing a joke?
Artyom asked hopefully.
A joke? Maybe. But he hasn't been seen since, so there's one thing I've understood. If it's your time, it's your time, and no guard's going to help you. Only you go a little slower. And I go everywhere in a twosome, with a partner, if you like, except in one tunnel. From Sukharevskaya to Turgenevskaya, which is a particular situation. If something happens, then they'll drag you out. And quickly. Get it?
Got it. So, they'll let us into Prospect Mir? I still have this thing.
Artyom pointed to his machine gun.
They'll let us onto the radial, but to the ring, definitely not. They wouldn't let you in anyway, and with that cannon, you don't have a hope. But we don't need to get in there. We don't need to hang around there for much time anyway. We'll just make a stop and then go on. You, have you ever been to Prospect Mir?
Only when I was little, but otherwise not,
Artyom admitted.
Well, why don't I get you up to speed, then? Basically, there aren't any guard posts there. They don't need them. There's a market there, and no one lives there, so everything is fine. But there's a passage there to the ring, which means to the Hansa, a radial station which doesn't belong to anyone, but the Hansa soldiers patrol it to keep order. Therefore, you have to behave yourself, got it? Or else they'll send you to hell, and they'll deny you access to all their stations. So when we get there, you crawl onto the platform and sit quietly. And that samovar of yours.
He nodded at Artyom's machine gun.
Don't go waving it around. I have to sort something out with someone, so you'll have to sit and wait. We'll go to Prospect. We'll have a talk about how to get through that damn passage to Sukharevskaya.
Bourbon went silent again, and Artyom was left to himself. The tunnel wasn't too bad here. The ground was a little damp, and there was a dark, thin stream following the rails headed in the same direction as they were. But after a while, there was a quiet rustle and squeaking sound, which sounded to Artyom like a nail scratching along glass, and it made him wince in aversion. The little beasts weren't visible yet, but their presence could already be felt.
Rats!
Artyom spat out the vile word, feeling a chill pass along his skin. They still visited his nightmares, although his memories of that terrible dark moment when his mother and their entire station were drowned in a flood of rats were almost erased from his memory. Were they actually erased? No. They had just gone deeper, like a needle that wasn't pulled out but gets stuck in the body. It travels around, having been pushed in by an insufficiently trained doctor. At first it will hide and stay still, but after a time an unknown force will set it in motion, and it will make its pernicious way through the arteries, the nerve ganglions, ripping up vital organs and dooming its carrier to intolerable torment. The memory of that time, of the blind fury and insatiable cruelty of those beasts, of the experiences of horror that the steel needle left deep in his subconscious, only came to disturb Artyom at night. And the mere sight of them, even the vague smell of them, created a sort of electrical discharge in him, forcing his body to shudder in reflex. For Artyom, and for his stepfather, and maybe for the other four who escaped with them on the trolley that day, rats were something much more frightening and loathsome than for the other inhabitants of the metro. There were almost no rats at Vidyenka. There were traps everywhere, and poison had been spread around, so Artyom had become unused to them. But they swarmed through the rest of the metro, and he'd forgotten about that, or rather, avoided thinking about it when he had taken the decision to go on this journey.
"What's up, boy? You afraid of rats?"
Bourbon inquired maliciously.
"Don't like them? You're painfully spoiled. But get used to it, they're everywhere. But that's okay, it's good even, you won't go hungry,"
he added and winked while Artyom was starting to feel nauseous.
"But really,"
Bourbon continued seriously,
"you're better to be afraid where there's no rats.
If there's no rats, then there's been some bad trouble, and if there's no people either, then you want to be afraid. But if the rats are running, then everything's normal. Business as usual. Get it?
There are people and there are people. And Artyom definitely didn't want to share his suffering with this guy. So he nodded and didn't say anything. There weren't that many rats, and they ran away from the light of the flashlight, and you hardly noticed them. But all the same, one of them managed to get underfoot, and Artyom stepped on something soft and slippery, only to hear a shrill squeal. Artyom lost his balance, and almost fell face down with all his equipment.
"Don't be afraid, boy. Don't be afraid,"
Bourbon cheered him up.
"It gets worse. There's a couple of passages in this shithole teeming with them, and you have to walk on the rails, and you're walking and crunching them underfoot."
And he snorted meanly for effect. Artyom frowned. He was silent, but he was squeezing his fists. He would have punched Bourbon right in his grinning face with pleasure. Suddenly, an indecipherable din came from far off, and Artyom immediately forgot the insult and clasped the handle of his automatic weapon and looked at Bourbon questioningly.
"Don't worry, everything's fine. We're coming up to Prospect,"
Bourbon reassured him and patted him patronizingly on the shoulder. Even though he'd warned Artyom that there were no guard posts at Prospect Mir, this was all very unusual for Artyom, to just go straight into another station without first seeing the weak light of a fire designating the border, without any obstacles along the way. When they got to the tunnel's exit, the din got louder and a glow of light became noticeable. Finally, there was some cast iron stairs to the left and a little bridge which took you up to the level of the platform. Bourbon's boots rattled up the iron steps, and after a few steps the tunnel turned to the left and opened up, and they were in the station. There was a bright white beam of light in their faces, invisible from the tunnel. There was a little table on the side at which sat a man in a strange and unfamiliar old-fashioned grey uniform, wearing a peak cap.
"Welcome,"
he greeted them, averting the flashlight.
"Trading or transit?"
While Bourbon stated the purpose of their visit, Artyom peered at the Prospect Mir metro station before him. On the platform along the pathways, twilight reigned, but there were arches lighted from the inside with a soft yellow light from which Artyom unexpectedly felt a squeeze in his chest. He wanted to be done with all the formalities, and to look at what was going on in the station, there where the arches were, from which this light was coming, so familiar and comforting that it almost hurt. And though it seemed to Artyom that he hadn't seen anything like it before, the sight of this light brought him back to the distant past, and suddenly a strange image appeared to him. A small home, flooded with warm yellow light. A woman is half reclined on a wide ottoman, and she is reading a book, but you can't see her face amidst the pastel wallpaper and the dark blue square of the window. The vision flashed in front of his mind, but melted a second later, leaving him puzzled and excited. What had he just seen? Could it be that the weak light coming from the station could project an old slide of his childhood that had been lost in his subconscious onto an invisible screen? Could that young woman who was peacefully reading a book on the spacious and comfortable ottoman be his mother? Artyom impatiently thrust his passport at the customs officer after agreeing, despite Bourbon's objections, to put his machine gun in their storage room for the duration of his visit. Then Artyom hurried along, attracted to the light behind the columns like a moth, towards the light and the din of a bazaar. Prospect Mir was different from Vedeyenche, from Alexeyevskaya, from Rishkaya. The prosperity of the Hansa meant that they had better illumination than the emergency lights that gave light to the stations that Artyom had known during his conscious life. No, these weren't the same lamps that lighted the metro in the old days. They were weak, glowing lights which hung overhead every 20 feet, drawn along a wire that went across the whole station. But for Artyom, who was used to the cloudy red emergency glow, to the unreliable light of fires, to the weak radiance from tiny pocket flashlights illuminating the inside of tents, the light of this station was totally strange. It was the same light that lit his early childhood, as far back as the time when life was at the surface, and he was charmed to be reminded of something that had long ago ceased to exist for him. So arriving at the lighted part of the station, Artyom didn't rush into the rows of traders like the others, but leant his back against a column, and partly covering his eyes with his hand, he stood and looked at the lamps again and again, until there was a sharp pain in his eyes.
You what, gone crazy or something? Why are you staring at them so hard? You want to lose your eyes? You'll be as blind as a puppy. And what'll I do with you?
Bourbon's voice resounded in Artyom's ears.
You've already gone and given them your balalaika, so you might as well go and have a look around at what the lamps are trying to show you.
Artyom cast a hostile look over at Bourbon, but he obeyed him anyway. There weren't all that many people at the station, but they spoke so loudly, trading, beckoning, demanding, trying to out-yell each other, that it became clear why it was all so audible from afar, from the approach to the tunnel. On both tracks, there were scraps of train structures, and some wagons were converted for habitation. Two rows of trays were arranged along the platform that displayed various utensils, some in orderly piles, others in sloppy heaps. On one side of the station there was an iron curtain, which stood in the place where there was once an exit to the surface, and on the opposite side there was a line of grey bags which clearly demarcated a line of firing positions. An unnaturally white banner hung from this ceiling, on which was painted a brown circle, the symbol of the ring. Beyond the firing line were four escalators which led to the ring circuit, and that's where the territory of the powerful Hansa began, which was closed to foreigners. The frontier guards beyond the fences were dressed in waterproof overalls, with the usual camouflage, but for some reason they were grey in colour.
Why do they have grey camouflage?
Artyom asked Bourbon.
They're fat animals, that's why,
he answered contemptuously.
You, now, you go ahead and look around while I do a little trading here.
There was nothing of particular interest to Artyom. There was tea, sticks of sausage, storage batteries for lamps, jackets and raincoats made from pigskin, some tattered books, most of which were pornography, half-liter bottles of a suspicious-looking substance with the inscription Home Brew written on crooked labels, and there really wasn't one trader selling weed which you used to be able to get hold of anywhere. Even the gaunt little man with a blue nose and watery eyes who was selling the dubious home brew told Artyom to get lost when he asked if he had a little stuff. There was a trader selling firewood, knotty logs and branches that some stalker had brought down from the surface. It was said to burn for a long time and produce little smoke. Here you paid for things in dimly gleaming Kalashnikov cartridges. 100 grams of tea was 5 cartridges. A stick of sausage was 15 cartridges. A bottle of homebrew was 20. They fondly called them little bullets.
Listen, man, look at this. What a cool jacket. It's cheap. Just 30 little bullets and it's yours. Okay, 25, and you'll take it now?
Looking at the neatly arranged rows of little bullets on the counters, Artyom recollected the words of his stepfather.
I once read that Kalashnikov was proud of his invention, that his automatic weapon was the most popular gun in the world. They say that he was particularly happy that thanks to his device the borders of his homeland were kept safe. I don't know. If I had invented that thing, I think I would have gone mad. To think that most murders have been committed with the help of your device. That's even scarier than being the inventor of the guillotine.
One cartridge. One death. Someone's life removed. 100 grams of tea cost 5 human lives. A length of sausage, very cheap if you please, just 15 lives. A quality leather jacket, on sale today, is just 25, so you're saving 5 lives. The daily exchange at this market was equal in lives to the entire population of the metro.
Well, so, did you find anything for yourself?
Bourbon came up and asked.
Nothing interesting here for me,
Artyom brushed the question away.
Uh-huh, you're right. It's full of garbage. But boy, this little station used to be the one place in this stinking metro station where you could find everything you want. You go there and they're all vying with one another, weapons, narcotics, girls, fake documents.
Bourbon sighed dreamily.
But these cretins,
he nodded at the Hansa flag,
have made this into a nursery school. You can't do this, you can't do that.
Okay, let's go and get your hoe. We need to keep going.
After getting Artyom's machine gun, they took a seat on the stone bench before entering the southern tunnel. It was murky there, and Bourbon had picked this spot especially in order to get their eyes used to the weaker light.
Basically, this is the deal. I can't vouch for myself. I've never done this, and so I don't know what I'm doing, and if we'll run into trouble. Touch wood, of course, but even so, if we run into something. Well, if I start sniveling or go deaf, then that should be okay. As far as I heard, everybody goes crazy in their own way. Our boys didn't make it back to Prospect. I think that they didn't get far, and we might bump into them today. So you get ready for that, because you're a little soft after all. And if I start to see red, I'll shut you up. That's the problem, you see. I don't know what to do. Well, okay.
Bourbon finally felt resolved after his hesitations.
Boy, you're all right, I guess. And you won't shoot a guy in the back. I'm going to give you my gun while we go through this passage. Watch it,
he warned, looking Artyom tenaciously in the eyes.
And don't be funny. I have a limited sense of humor.
He shook some rags out of his rucksack, and then carefully pulled out a machine gun that was wrapped in plastic packaging. It was also a Kalashnikov, but it was cut off like the ones held by the Hansa border guards, with a hinged butt and a short socket instead of the long one that Artyom had. Bourbon took the magazine out of it and put it back in his rucksack, throwing the rags in after it.
Hold this,
he gave Artyom the weapon.
And don't pack it away. It might prove useful, though the passage looks quiet.
And Bourbon didn't finish his sentence, but jumped onto the pathway.
Okay, let's go. The sooner you go, the sooner you get there.
It was frightening. When they went from Vedeyenche to Ryshkaya, Artyom knew that anything could happen, but at least people went back and forth along those tunnels every day, and he knew that there was an inhabited station ahead of them where they were expected. It was just as unpleasant as it always was for anyone leaving a lighted and peaceful place. Even when they were headed for Prospect Mir from Ryshkaya, despite his doubts, he could amuse himself with the thought that ahead of him lay a Hansa station, that there was somewhere to go where he could relax in safety. But it was terrifying here. The tunnel that lay before them was totally black, and an unusual, total, absolute darkness reigned. It was so thick you could almost touch it. As porous as a sponge, it greedily swallowed the rays of their flashlight, which was hardly sufficient to illuminate even a foot ahead. Straining to the limits of his hearing, Artyom attempted to distinguish the smallest germ of that strange and painful noise, but it was in vain. Sounds probably had as hard a time getting through this darkness as light did. Even the bold crashing of Bourbon's boots sounded limp and mute in this tunnel. On the right wall, suddenly, there was a gap. The flashlight beam sank into a black spot, and Artyom didn't immediately understand that it was simply a side passage which exited sideways from the main tunnel. He looked at Bourbon questioningly.
Don't be scared. There was a transfer passage here,
he explained,
so that trains could get directly onto the ring without transferring at other stations. But the Hansa filled it in. They're not fools. They wouldn't leave an open tunnel pointing straight at them.
After that, they walked in silence for quite a long time. But the silence was getting more and more oppressive, and finally Artyom couldn't bear it.
Listen, Bourbon, he said, trying to disperse any hallucinations. Is it true that some morons attacked the caravan here not long ago?
Bourbon didn't answer at once, and Artyom thought that perhaps he hadn't heard the question, and was about to repeat it when Bourbon responded.
I heard something like that, but I wasn't here then, so I can't tell you for sure.
His words made a dull sound, and Artyom barely caught their sense, and had a hard time separating the words he heard from his own grinding thoughts about the fact that everything was so hard to hear in this tunnel.
What? No one saw it? There are stations at either end. How could that be? Where could they have gone?
He continued, and not because he was especially interested in the answer, but simply in order to hear his own voice. Several minutes went by before Bourbon replied at last. But this time, Artyom hadn't wanted to rush him, because there was an echo of the words he had just said resounding in his head, and he was too busy listening to them.
They say that somewhere here there's a kind of hatch. It's covered over. It's not really visible. Well, how likely is it anyway that you'd see something in this darkness,
Bourbon added with a sort of unnatural irritation in his voice. It took some time for Artyom to remember what they were talking about, and he agonizingly tried to catch hold of the sense of it all and to pose another question simply because he wanted to continue the conversation. Even if it was clumsy and difficult, it was saving them from the silence. "And is it always so dark in here?" Artyom asked, feeling a bit spooked that his words made such little sound, as though there was something covering his ears.
"Dark? Yes, always. Everywhere is dark. It comes in, the great darkness, and it shrouds the world, and it will dominate eternally,"
Bourbon responded, making strange pauses.
"What's that, a book or something?"
Artyom said, noticing that he had to make increasing efforts to catch the sound of his own words, and also paying attention to the fact that Bourbon's language had altered in a frightening way. But Artyom didn't have enough strength to be surprised by this.
"A book. Be afraid of truths concealed in ancient volumes, where words are embossed in golden paper. Slate black, they don't decay,"
Bourbon said ponderously, and Artyom was struck by the thought that the man wasn't turning to speak to him as he had before.
"Beautiful,"
Artyom almost yelled.
"Where does it come from?"
"And beauty will be overthrown and crushed, and the prophets will choke, endeavoring to pronounce their premonitions. For a day, the future will be blacker than their most ominous fears, and what they see will poison their reason,"
Bourbon continued quietly. Suddenly he stopped and he turned his head to the left so sharply that Artyom could hear how his vertebrae cracked, and he looked Artyom straight in the eye. Artyom started and stepped backwards, groping for his machine gun just in case. Bourbon looked at it with wide-open eyes, but his pupils were contracted into two tiny dots, even though in the pitch-black darkness of the tunnel they should have been thrown open to their limits in an attempt to capture as much light as possible. His face seemed unnaturally peaceful. Not one muscle was tense, and there was even a contemptuous smile, which had just disappeared from his lips.
"I've died,"
Bourbon said.
"There is no more me."
And as straight as a crossed eye, he fell face down. And then that same terrible sound rushed into Artyom's ears, but this time it did not expand and amplify gradually as it had the last time. No, it burst suddenly at full volume, deafening him and knocking him from his feet. The sound was more powerful here than it had been when he met it before, and Artyom, laid out on the ground, couldn't muster the will to stand for some time. But once he had covered his ears like before, and yelling as loudly as he could, he rushed and got up from the ground. Then he picked up the flashlight that had fallen from Bourbon's hands. He started feverishly to scan the walls, trying to find the source of the noise, the broken pipe. But the pipes were absolutely intact here, and the sound was coming from somewhere above. Bourbon was lying there, immobile, still face down, and when Artyom turned him over, he saw that Bourbon's eyes were still open. Artyom tried hard to remember what to do in situations like this, and he put his hand on the man's wrist to look for a pulse. Even if it was as weak as a thread or inconsistent, he wanted to feel it, but it was useless. Then he grabbed Bourbon by the hands, and pouring with sweat, he dragged his ever heavier body forward, straight out of this place. It was fiendishly hard, and made even more so because he had forgotten to remove his companion's rucksack. After a few dozen steps, Artyom suddenly stumbled on something soft and his nose was struck by a sickening and slightly sweet smell. He immediately remembered the words, "We might bump into them," and he redoubled his efforts, trying not to look underfoot, passing bodies stretched out on the rails. He pulled and pulled Bourbon along. Bourbon's head hung lifelessly and his hands were growing cold and slipping out of Artyom's sweaty hands, but he didn't acknowledge it. He didn't want to acknowledge it. He had to get Bourbon out of there, and he had promised him. They had an agreement. The noise gradually began to die down and suddenly disappeared. Again there was a deathly silence, and feeling an enormous relief, Artyom allowed himself to finally sit down on the rails and catch his breath. Bourbon was lying motionless next to him, and Artyom was looking with despair at his pale face as he breathed heavily. After about 5 minutes, he made himself get up onto his feet, and, taking Bourbon by the wrists, he moved forward, stumbling. His head was absolutely empty, apart from the vicious determination to drag this person to the next station. Then his legs buckled and he tumbled onto the cross ties, but after lying there for a few minutes, he crawled forward and grabbed Bourbon by the collar.
"I'll get there, I'll 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 get there,"
he assured himself, although he barely believed it. Having lost his strength entirely, he pulled his machine gun down from his shoulder and switched the safety lock to single shots, and he directed the barrel to the south, let out a shot and called out,
"People!"
But the last sound that he heard was not a human voice, but the rustle of rat paws. He didn't know how long he had lain there like that, gripping Bourbon by the collar, squeezing the handle of his machine gun, when his eyes perceived a ray of light. An unfamiliar old man with a flashlight in one hand and a strange gun in the other was standing above him.
"My young friend," he was saying in a pleasant and sonorous voice, "you can't forget about your friend. He's as dead as Ramses II. Do you want to stay here and reunite with him in the heavens as soon as possible, or can he wait for you for a little while?"
"Help me to take him to the station," Artyom asked the man in a weak voice, covering his eyes from the light.
"I'm afraid that it's necessary for us to reject that idea," the man said bitterly. "I am resolutely against turning the metro station of Sukharevskaya into a tomb. It's not even that comfortable as it is. And then, if we take this lifeless body there, then it's unlikely that anyone in the station will undertake to put him on his final path in a respectable way. What difference does it make whether the body decomposes here or at the station if its immortal soul has already returned to his creator? Or to be reincarnated, depending on your religious views, although all religions are mistaken to differing degrees."
"I promised him," Artyom sighed. "We had an agreement."
"My friend," the unfamiliar man said, frowning, "I'm starting to lose my patience. My rules don't tell me to help the dead when there are enough living people that need help. I am returning to Sukharevskaya. I'm getting rheumatism from spending a long time in this tunnel. If you want to see your companion as soon as possible, I advise you to stay here. The rats and the other lovely creatures will help you with that. And if you are concerned about the legal aspect of the question, then the contract is considered terminated if there is no objection from the other party."
"But I can't just leave him here,"
Artyom quietly tried to convince his rescuer.
"This was a living being. Leave him to the rats."
This, by the looks of it, was indeed a living person,
the man responded, inspecting the body skeptically.
"But now it is definitely a dead person, and that isn't the same thing. Okay, if you want, we can return here and you can make a cremation bonfire or whatever it is that you do in such circumstances.
Now get up,"
he ordered, and Artyom got to his feet reluctantly. Despite his protests, the stranger decisively pulled the rucksack off Bourbon's back and threw it over his shoulder, and supporting Artyom, he quickly walked forward. At first, Artyom had a hard time walking, but it was as if with each step the old man was giving Artyom injections of his ebullient energy. The pain in his feet subsided, and his rational mind returned gradually. He was looking intently into the face of his rescuer. By the looks of him, the man was over 50, but he looked surprisingly fresh and robust. His arms, which were supporting Artyom, were firm and didn't once tremble with fatigue the whole way back. His short hair was turning grey, and his little sculpted beard surprised Artyom. The man looked too well-groomed for the metro, especially given the godforsaken place where it seemed this man lived.
"What happened with you, friend?"
the unfamiliar man asked Artyom.
"It doesn't look like an attack, but more like he was poisoned. And I really want to hope that it's not what I think it is," he added, not going into what exactly it was that he feared.
"No, he died by himself," Artyom said, not having the strength to explain the circumstances of Bourbon's death, which he himself was only just starting to get his head around. "It's a long story, I'll tell you later."
The tunnel suddenly widened, and they appeared to have arrived at the station. Something seemed strange to Artyom here, something unusual, and a few seconds later he understood what it was.
"It's what, dark here?"
he asked his companion in dismay.
"There's no authorities here," the man replied. "So there's no one to provide light for the people. That's why whoever needs light has to get it himself. Some can, some can't. But don't be afraid. Luckily, I'm acquainted with the top ranks."
And he quickly climbed onto the platform and held out a hand to Artyom. They turned into the first archway and went into a hall. There was only one long passage, a colonnade with arches on both sides and the usual iron walls, the stalled escalators. Barely lighted by weak little fires and most of it plunged in darkness, Sukharevskaya was an oppressive vision and very sad. Crowds of people swarmed around the fires, some were sleeping on the floor, and strange half-bent figures in rags wandered from fire to fire. They were all clustered in the middle of the hall, as far from the tunnels as they could be. The bonfire to which the stranger led Artyom was noticeably brighter than the rest of them, and it was located in the center of the platform.
"One day this station will burn to the ground," Artyom thought aloud, looking despondently at the hall. "In 420 days,
his companion said calmly.
"So it's best you leave before then. In any case, that's what I plan to do."
"How do you know?" Artyom asked and froze, remembering in a flash all that he had heard about magicians and psychics and scrutinizing the face of his companion, looking for the markings of unearthly knowledge.
"The mother heart python is unsettled," he answered, smiling. "Okay, that's all. You must have a sleep, and then we'll introduce ourselves and have a talk."
With these last words, Artyom suddenly was overcome by monstrous fatigue which had accumulated in the tunnel before Ishkaya, in his nightmares, in the recent tests of his will. Artyom had no more strength to resist, and he got down onto a piece of tarpaulin that was spread near the fire, and put his rucksack under his head, and fell into a long, deep, and dreamless sleep. Chapter 6. The Rights of the Strong. The ceiling was so sooty that there wasn't a trace left of the whitewash that had once been applied to it. Artyom looked dully at it, not knowing quite where he was.
"You're awake?"
he heard a familiar voice, forcing the scatterings of thoughts to build a picture of yesterday's, was it yesterday, events. It all seemed unreal to him now. Opaque, like fog, the wall of sleep had separated actuality from recollections.
"Good evening,"
Artyom said to the man who had found him. He was sitting on the other side of the fire, and Artyom could see him through the flames. There was a mysterious, even mystical quality to the man's face.
Now we can introduce ourselves to each other. I have a regular name, similar to all the other people that surround you in your life. It's too long, and it says nothing about me. But I am the latest incarnation of Genghis Khan. So you can call me Khan. It's shorter. Genghis Khan?
Artyom looked at the man disbelievingly. Artyom didn't believe in reincarnation.
My friend,
Khan objected as though insulted,
you don't need to look into my eyes and at my behavior with such obvious suspicion. I have been incarnated in various other and more easily acceptable forms too, but Genghis Khan remains the most significant stage along my path, even though I don't remember anything from that life, unfortunately.
So, why Khan and not Genghis?
Artyom pushed further.
Khan isn't a surname after all, it's just a professional assignation, if I remember correctly.
It brings up unnecessary reference, not to mention Genghis Aitmatov,
his companion said reluctantly and incomprehensibly.
And by the way, I don't consider it my duty to explain the origins of my name to whoever asks. What's your name?
I'm Artyom, and I don't know who I was in the previous life. Maybe my name was also a little more resounding back then, said Artyom.
Nice to meet you,
Khan said, obviously completely satisfied with his answer.
I hope you will share my modest meal,
he added, lifting and hanging a battered metal kettle over the fire. It was just like the ones they had at the Northern Patrol of Edeyenche. Artyom stood up and put his hand in his rucksack and pulled out a stick of sausage, which he'd acquired on his way from Fedeyenche. He cut off several pieces with his penknife and put them on a clean rag that was also inside his rucksack.
Here,
he extended it towards his new acquaintance.
To go with tea.
Khan's tea was Vedienche tea, which Artyom recognized. Sipping the tea from an enameled metal mug, he silently recalled the events of the day before. His host obviously was also thinking his own thoughts, and he didn't bother Artyom. The madness lashing at the world from the broken pipes seemed to have a different effect on everyone. Artyom was able to hear it simply as a deafening noise that didn't let you concentrate, a noise which killed your thoughts but spared your mind itself, whereas Bourbon simply couldn't stand the powerful attack and died. Artyom hadn't expected that the noise could actually kill someone, otherwise he would never have agreed to take one step into that black tunnel between Prospekt Mir and Sukharevskaya. This time, the noise had snuck up surreptitiously, at first dulling the senses. Artyom was now sure that all usual sounds had been muted and the noise itself had been inaudible at first, but then it froze the flow of thoughts, so they were suddenly covered with the hoarfrost of weakness, and finally, it delivered its crushing blow. And why hadn't he immediately noticed that Bourbon had suddenly started talking in terms that he couldn't possibly have known, even if he had read lots of apocalyptical prophecies? The noise went deeper into Bourbon as if bewitching him, and a strange intoxication had taken hold. Artyom himself had been thinking all sorts of rubbish about the fact that he mustn't go silent, that they had to keep talking, but it hadn't occurred to him to try to figure out what was going on. Something had been interfering. He wanted to throw all that had happened out of his consciousness, to forget it all. It was impossible to get his head around it. In all his years at Fedeyenche, he had only heard about such things. It had been easier to think that anything he'd heard was just not possible in this world. Artyom shook his head and looked from side to side again. The same suffocating twilight filled the space. Artyom thought that it had probably never been light here, and that it could only get darker when the fuel reserves for the fire ended. The clock above the entrance to the tunnel had stopped ticking a long time ago, since there was no one who took care of such things. Artyom wondered why Khan had said good evening to him, because according to his calculations, it should be morning or midday.
Is it really evening?
He asked Khan, puzzled.
It's evening for me,
Khan replied pensively.
What do you mean?
Artyom didn't understand.
See, Artyom, you obviously come from a station where the clock works
and you all look at it in awe, comparing the time on your wristwatch to the red numbers above the tunnel entrance. For you, time is the same for everyone, just like light. Well, here it's the opposite. Nothing is anyone else's business. No one is obliged to make sure there's light for all the people who have made their way here. Go up to anybody here and suggest just that, and it will seem absurd to them. Whoever needs light has to bring it here with them. It's the same with time. Whoever needs to know the time, whoever is afraid of chaos, needs to bring their own time with them. Everyone keeps some time here, their own time. And it's different for everybody, and it depends on their calculations. But they're all equally right, and each person believes in their own time, and subordinates their life to its rhythms. For me, it's evening right now. For you, it's morning. And what? People like you are so careful about storing up the hours you spend wandering, just as ancient peoples kept pieces of glowing coal in smoldering crucibles, hoping to resurrect fire from them. But there are others who lost their piece of coal, maybe even threw it away. You know, in the metro it is basically always night time, and it makes no sense to keep track of time here, so painstakingly. Explode your hours, and you'll see how time will transform. It's very interesting. It changes. You won't even recognize it. It will cease to be fragmented, broken into the sections of hours, minutes, and seconds. Time is like mercury. Scatter it, and it will grow together again. It will again find its own integrity and indeterminacy. People tamed it, shackled it into pocket watches and stopwatches, and for those that hold time on a chain, time flows evenly. But try to free it and you will see. It flows differently for different people. For some it is slow and viscous, counted in the inhalations and exhalations of smoked cigarettes. For others it races along, and they can only measure it in past lives. You think it's morning now. There is a great likelihood that you are right. There's a roughly 25% likelihood. Nevertheless, this morning of yours has no sense to it, since it's up there on the surface, and there's no life up there anymore. Well, there are no more people, anyway. Does what occurs above have value for those who never go there? No. So when I say good evening to you, if you like, you can answer good morning. There's no time in this station, except perhaps one, and it's very strange. Now it is the 419th day, and I'm counting backwards. He went silent, sipping on his hot tea, and Artyom thought it was funny when he remembered that at Vedienka the station clock was treated as a holy thing, and any failure of it immediately put anyone nearby under the hot hand of blame. The authorities would be astonished to learn that time doesn't exist, though the thought of it had just been lost. What Khan had just described reminded Artyom of a funny thing that he had been surprised by repeatedly as he grew up.
They say that before, when trains used to run in the wagons, they used to announce, "Be careful of the closing doors. The next stop is XYZ, and the next platform will appear on your left or right," he said. "Is that true?"
"Does it seem strange to you?" Khan raised his eyebrows.
"How could they tell which side the platform would be on? If I'm coming from the south to the north, then the platform is on the right. If I'm coming from the north to the south, then it's on the left. And the seats on the train were against the walls of the train, if I remember right. So for the passengers, the platforms were either in front of them or behind them. Half of them on one side and the other half on the other, with different perspectives."
"You're right," Khan answered respectfully.
"Basically, the train drivers were only speaking for themselves, because they traveled in a compartment at the front. And for them, right was absolute right and left was absolute left. So they must have mostly been saying it for their own benefit. So in principle, they might as well have said nothing. But I have heard these words since I was a child, and I was so used to them that I had never stopped to consider them."
Some time passed, and then he said,
You promised to tell me what happened to your friend.
Artyom paused for a moment, wondering if he should tell this man about the mysterious circumstances surrounding the death of Bourbon, about the noise that he had heard twice now in the last 24 hours, about its